Coming up today, tracking trolls, we go inside the amazing new Lego house and sit down with Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella. You're listening to episode 338 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Turk.
Hello.
And Matthew Reynolds.
Hello.
Long-time podcast listeners might remember Matt. He went, but now he's back. Welcome again.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, it's good to have you back.
Yeah.
Would you like to start us with a fact?
Yeah, I think it's a good one. I was saying to James, it came to me in a dream. You know you have space in an atom between the kind of nucleus and the electrons that kind of orbit around it?
Mm-hmm.
If we took all that space out and compressed all of that matter as tightly as it could go, the entire human population, all kind of 7 billion of us, would fit into a teaspoon, a very, very heavy teaspoon.
Wow.
Wow. Cool, so wait, so just to clarify, this is an actual fact and not just a theory you cooked up in your dream.
Yeah, when I said it came to me in a dream, I mean, I heard it last week and then I remembered it, probably not in a dream, but, you know, at some other point. So yeah, it's probably legit. I'm pretty
good
sure.
Fact.
That's deep, man. Deep.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. Vicky, what did you learn this week?
I learned a few Lego acronyms.
Okay.
And I want to see if you guys know them.
You realize become Wired's Lego correspondent.
I always was. So there's sort of a whole language that Lego fans have, and this includes like lots of acronyms. So do you know the following? AFOL, AFOL.
A fun overall Lego.
No.
A fittingly oblong Lego.
I would say good guesses, but they're not really.
Okay.
An AFOL is an adult fan of Lego.
Oh.
I am an AFOL.
I am an AFOL.
Okay. We are all AFOLs.
Yeah.
What about MOC? MOC.
You go first, Matt.
Well, it's obviously Multicoloured Object Coordinator.
That's a really good guess. I'm not going to do better than that. It makes sense. No, I'm not. I can't even.
It's my own creation.
Aww.
Which means a Lego design that you've kind of put together yourself. So not one that's on the box, but one where you've taken the pieces and invented your own creation.
I've gone
never
rogue.
Do that. You know what? I always like tried to sit down with the box and be like, oh, I've built a wall, another wall. Yeah,
it's all... A house where everything's a bit wonky.
Yeah, it was rubbish.
All right, final one for you. This one's quite advanced. Snot. S-N-O-T.
Oh, a... Seriously? No, I don't. Come on. This is impossible.
No ideas?
Super nefarious. I don't know. It's obvious. No.
It's
no.
Studs not on top.
Ooh.
This is an advanced building technique.
Yes.
Which basically means that you build... So you know you've got the studs, the little blobs on top of Lego bricks.
Lug nuts.
Yeah.
Whatever you call them. They are studs.
There's a real name for them.
No.
It's where you build so that they're not showing, so you end up with a smooth finish.
But wait, how does that work? Because the bottom is like kind of weird and empty.
So there's different pieces you can use, and I guess you're using the side of the brick.
Ooh.
And then angling them in certain ways so that you have that smooth, stud-free
And that's
surface.
Snot.
Studs not on top.
That's great. Cool. Well, it's nice to know you've been spending your time well. I learned this week that more Americans have Amazon Prime, 52%, than go to church, 51%, or own a gun, 44%.
Really?
Yeah.
52%?
52% of Americans have an Amazon Prime
account.
That's
a lot, isn't it?
That is a lot.
I mean, all of them
are
a lot.
Really impressive.
In this list, they're all a bit on the high side.
Well, yeah.
But especially the Amazon Prime one.
More people in America have an Amazon Prime account than go to church.
Mm.
That is phenomenal.
Maybe the church should do a Prime account, God Prime.
Mm, to your door, yeah. 1 hour delivery of sermons.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Matt, we'll start with your story, which is based on the incredibly tragic events of this week in Las Vegas, where a good number of people lost their lives and hundreds were injured. It's still a story that's developing. But one thing that we wanted to look into was... people that lie on social media when things like this happen. So it's a very, very sensitive story, but we felt that this was one way that we could add to it.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess as we all have kind of experienced, social media during these kind of ongoing tragedies, it's a bit of a weird place, isn't it? There's kind of all types of videos that people shouldn't really be sharing that are kind of quite, you know, horrible, all kinds of inappropriate stuff. And one thing that has happened a lot of times, and we saw again with like Las Vegas, is that people would share posts that they said were, you know, about a family member or, you know, someone had gone missing. And it kind of quite quickly become clear that that these were faked. And I guess, you know, I wanted to find out really kind of why people do this. But, you know, example of a type of thing that we saw in Las Vegas is that, you know, kind of tweet that sounds quite, you know, genuine. You know, it says, my dad is missing after Las Vegas shooting. Please retweet and share. We're distraught. But the picture attached to it was actually of this adult actor, someone called Johnny Sins, which was kind of like quickly called out on the internet because people knew. I'm not sure really perhaps if to the person sending it, it was an obvious joke because they knew who this, you know, this porn star was. But it seemed to me that it was, you know, deliberately designed to kind of, you know, get some traction. So I guess I went and spoke to the trolls to find out, you know, why they did it.
Yeah, which is, some people called us out on this, saying that we shouldn't give attention to the people that are doing this. And we also should say that this isn't a new phenomenon around the Manchester attack, and I'm sure other events of this magnitude in recent years, people do silly things on social media. But it's to lie in this way is quite pernicious, and it's an interesting it's interesting to try and work out why people are doing this. And there's been academic studies, there's been books published into it, but we wanted to hear from them directly, so off you went.
Yeah, totally. So I spoke to two of the trolls. So the person that authored that tweet I just read out, it got kind of 600 retweets before it was taken down. 4,000 people reported it. So, you know, I spoke to him, and at first, actually, he kind of like tried to keep up the myth. I think he kind of thought it was funny. He was saying, you know, that really is my dad. You know, why are you kind of talking to me now? But, you know, after a little bit of kind of needling, you know, he said stuff kind of like, well, it seemed what happened is that he'd seen this tweet on someone else's timeline. He'd just copied and pasted it and tried to pass it on as his own. And he was kind of like competing with other people on Twitter to see who could get the most retweets off the same or similar tweets. When you kind of go through his timeline, there's all types of stuff saying like, you know, great work on the retweets. Weirdly, it was all part of this kind of Call of Duty kind of clan. And in fact, both of the trolls that I spoke to were both kind of 17-year-old males. One was from Italy, one was from London. And it all seemed tied up in this kind of like this kind of macho one-upmanship that was a bit like, lol, you know, I took this. In fact, when I spoke to this person, he said, he sent this tweet like basically an hour after the shooting started. So, you know, the news reports really, we knew so little at that point. You know, he said, I just copied and pasted it. I was in class and I didn't even know what was happening. It was like just morning in Italy.
Yeah.
You know, other things that people said, you know, they said, oh, you know, I thought it'd be funny. You know, I have a bit of a dark sense of humour. Both of the people I spoke to were kind of pretty aware that people would think it's kind of, you know, making fun of people that are dead or injured or people's grief. But yeah, they kind of framed it saying, well, they don't really understand. Like, I've just got a bit of a kooky sense of humour and I'm just trying to, you know, they even said, oh, I'm trying to lighten the mood. It seemed pretty...
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Yeah,
odd.
And it's a very, very stupid thing to do, to put it lightly. But in seriousness, this could land people in a lot of trouble or cause a lot of unnecessary distress. I mean, I remember waking up on the morning when this news was breaking. It was around 8 a.m. UK time. And the BBC... you know, a massively respected, well-resourced news organisation, was taking its information from Twitter. Mm. So people's ability to very, very quickly reach huge audiences with lies, it's dangerous. So you spoke to someone with expertise in this area to find out a bit more.
Yeah, so I spoke to a really interesting researcher in this area. Her name's Whitney Phillips, and she's written kind of two books on trolls. So she totally has quite a good insight into their mindset, I think. You know, I think, you know, part of what she said is that the kind of trolls kind of talk in this kind of slightly, well, super ironic register that's really been honed on places like 4chan and, you know, some of the more horrible kind of subreddits. And And this is kind of what I kind of got back from, that they have this kind of thing where, oh, you know, we just say what, you know, where anything goes, because you don't really see the repercussions. You know, what Whitney said to me was, well, if people actually, you know, had to deal with the repercussions that the things they post on Twitter could cause, you know, they wouldn't be saying these things at all. You know, it's all this kind of very kind of like, you know, this very detached, ironic, oh, I just say it and then who cares what happens? You know, very kind of like, you know, studied kind of detachment.
I can kind of see that, I guess, because you have these internet communities that often sort of have their own sense of humour and sometimes even their own kind of language that they use.
Yeah.
And as an outsider looking at it, you don't necessarily immediately get it or understand why something's funny. I mean, often it isn't funny, right? But then when you maybe bring that into a more public forum, like Twitter, which is, you know, bigger than just like one 4chan board or something.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, you're confronted with a bunch of people who are suddenly like, wait, we don't share that kind of thing here. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, so I'd say that this isn't a technology problem, right? There will have been people after events like this that make very bad jokes, have very, very bad conversations, say nasty things, think it's funny, and they do that in the privacy of their own homes or in a pub or a bar or wherever it may be in private. And that's what happens on 4chan. It's what happens on Reddit. It's what probably happens all over the internet. But the problem with the technology is it allows that sort of stuff to happen at scale. So once you take it to Twitter, it just starts, what's the right word for it? Like rolling.
Snowballing.
Right? Snowballing, yeah.
I mean, to be honest, it's unacceptable anywhere, right? But
yes.
It, you know, the more people it reaches, the bigger destructive impact.
Then
it
becomes
has.
A problem. I guess if it's private, it's private. It's still wrong, but it's not affecting other people directly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is the thing. So, because, you know, I put this to both the trolls I spoke to and they, you know, they completely agreed that it's inappropriate and kind of disgusting. And I said, you know, would you make this type of joke to anyone in real life? And they said, oh, it's something I might talk about with my closest friends. And, you know, while with the caveat that, you know, it's obviously horrible and always wrong, I could kind of see that. And then there's this other interesting element that when I spoke to both of them about Twitter, one of them was very into what he called football Twitter, which apparently is full of racist memes and kind of like, you know, really horrible kind of like parodies and, you know, like frequently like really horrible. The other one, you know, his bit of Twitter, if you like, was Call of Duty Twitter. And, you know, I kind of poked around and obviously all these people were sharing horrible stuff. But the reason they were kind of connected, they had handles that often had the same kind of Call of Duty clan name and stuff. And what kind of struck me is kind of what you were just saying, Vicky, is that it was almost like these people thought they knew what Twitter was because their bit of Twitter was Call of Duty Twitter, where everyone shares racist memes and everyone says horrible things. But then they'd got this kind of weird thing where sometimes they could punch through the fourth wall and it kind of came out into this open world. And I was like, well, this isn't my Twitter. And I kind of thought that I knew what Twitter was like. And it's this interesting, well, you know, interesting and horrible way that you've got these kind of worlds kind of mixing together. In a kind of like a, you know, kind of horrible way, really.
You've inadvertently described filter bubbles.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly what that problem is. And it's easy to forget we're all journalists. So we're on journalists' Twitter,
which is
a very self-righteous place where people post lots of links to things that happen on BuzzFeed. And that's what it is. It's a very, very different place to the Twitter that you guys listening probably use yourselves, whether you follow it because you enjoy a sport or you enjoy finding out what's happening in the world or following friends or family. Everyone has a different experience. And as you say, occasionally these bubbles kind of pop into each other.
Yeah.
And around an event like Las Vegas, when idiots decide to have a bit of fun, it really, really, the whole thing just falls apart.
Yeah. And that's the thing. So Whitney kind of like, you know, said this to me that maybe it comes back to us and I don't know, maybe we should be thinking a little bit more like, you know, should we be, you know, as media, you know, do we have a kind of responsibility to ignore these things because we realize they're bad and actually shouldn't get any kind of promotion? Or I think, you know, my human reaction is this is such a weird, macabre, horrible thing to do. Like, you know, and it's so new and it feels so weird that you want to kind of like explain it and rationalize it. On their side, they're just a bit like, I'm a 17-year-old boy, lol, I'll just say a thing and wow, I can reach a million people. So I'm kind of interested, you know, Whitney kind of said to me, well, actually, rather than thinking about why they do it, we should be thinking, well, what can we do to stop it, you know, as opposed to Twitter? And maybe the answer is, we stop thinking, you know, realizing it happens, we stop paying it attention.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. So it's just like attention-seeking behavior, and maybe by kind of talking about it or covering it or reporting the accounts, you're actually sort
So this was a criticism of Matt's article, and I think you saw some of these people sharing your article afterwards.
Yeah, they spoke to me about it. They said, oh, the people you're talking about say hi, by the way. Can you find him? He's just changed a letter in his username. Which, you know, and actually, it was interesting to me, right, from the same perspective. You know, it didn't really kind of like necessarily kind of get under my skin, but it did make me think kind of like, you know, did I feed the trolls?
Right. So that's one of the arguments, and that was what Whitney said. Maybe if we ignore them, they go away. But as I said, it's not a technology problem because it's just reflecting how people behave in society. But it is a technology problem because Twitter can fix it.
Mm.
If people are posting pictures of porn stars saying that they're missing and they're getting 4,000 reports that that post is abusive, is fake, they can be quicker. They can 100% be quicker before it gets 600 retweets. They can use machine learning algorithms to analyze pictures when there are a number of reports against them to very, very quickly identify it for what it is and get rid of it.
I mean, probably yes, that's true. But I can also see it's a difficult situation, and it's a difficult one to judge, and it's difficult to rely on machine learning technology for that kind of thing, because you know, there is always the chance that that person may have been missing, and maybe someone used a photo that was online. So you could do image recognition, but maybe that's just the easiest photo that a family member or something had. So you know, and I guess the risk of those false positives with that kind of thing, when the stakes are so high, it's tough to draw the line, isn't it?
Yeah, but is there's a difference, right, between removing something inside half an hour or an hour and removing something inside of a few hours. So most
That's
of these
true.
Posts were up for most of the day.
Oh, yeah. Easily,
and
like six, seven
if
hours.
Twitter was really on top of this sort of thing, it probably could have worked it out. BuzzFeed had written an article calling out all of them. They were getting thousands of reports that these were fake. Some of them were so obviously fake. One of them was a picture of Arsenal midfielder and German international Mesut Ozil. And that was just so obviously trolling that it didn't even really warrant any attention. So I'd like to finish this on, as you say, you found one of the trolls again and they just added a different letter to their name. And this is the other problem. You can ban them and they all get banned, but they just come back.
Oh, yeah, completely. So I spoke to, you know, one of the trolls, you know, I put this question to both of them, you know, would you come back? And, you know, and one of them said, I've already had six, you know, banned accounts. You know, I'll just come back again. It's as easy as that. And, you know, the other one said exactly the same and did exactly the same. I mean, on the night that, you know, I put the article out, they were, you know, back retweeting it, sharing it with their fans. And the thing that struck me is that you only really need to kind of like click on one of these usernames, scroll down and just think they shouldn't be on Twitter, because all the stuff they're sharing is kind of, you know, I mean, it feels like, you know, finding one and kind of getting into that network. I don't know. I just kind of, I understand like about the problems with banning these accounts at scale and stuff. But it just feels like, God, it's so easy to find horrible stuff that really shouldn't be there. Maybe it should be easier to kind of like take that down as well.
Yeah, it's an incredibly, incredibly complicated area around should everyone who's online have to be registered to a specific person? Is anonymity online a problem? Networks operating at this scale, how do you police them? We're nowhere near solving it yet, but it feels like every time we have events like this that we're hitting up against the same old problems all over again. So progress does need to be made, certainly at a quicker rate than it is at the moment. We'll leave that one there. I do encourage everyone to go and read Matt's article. It's a really interesting insight into quite a horrible subsection of the internet. We'll leave that one there. Our second story this week is a bit of a change of pace. LEGO correspondent Vicky Turk went to LEGO in Billund, Denmark last week.
Last week, Wednesday.
Time flies. What did you see?
I saw, I mean, this is a change of tone, isn't it?
it's fine.
But yeah, a happy story now. I went to Billund in Denmark, which is the home of LEGO. It's where they've been since their founding. And I saw the new LEGO house.
What is the LEGO house?
What is the LEGO house? The LEGO house is a celebration of all things LEGO.
So this isn't their office?
No, this isn't their office. It's the... There's a Legoland, there's their offices, there's a factory, all in Billund. But this is a new building, and it's basically, it houses a museum telling the history of Lego, and it's got sort of loads of different experiences. So you can go and you can build things, and you can see these amazing sculptures of Lego, and just really basically immerse yourselves in all things Lego.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's amazing. So yeah, the building's designed by architect Bjarke Ingels and his colleagues. And it's really cool because they took the Lego brick itself as their key inspiration. So the whole building looks like sort of 21 big giant Lego bricks stacked on top of each other. And there's loads of little nods to the brick.
The whole thing.
So it's a real homage.
Yeah, it's really an homage. And we made a video. Vicky went along with a videographer. You can watch it on our YouTube channel, and there's an article all about it on the website. But here's a little clip of Bjarke Ingels explaining some details about the Lego house.
If you're an architect, then you're invited to create the home of Lego. And Lego is all about, you know, building. We kind of made the dogma that we wouldn't design anything that wouldn't be immediately buildable in Lego. One aspect of Lego is to almost boil things down into the essentials with, like, with how few bricks can you actually make something recognizable. Also, we knew where it was going to be placed here in the heart of Billund, the hometown of Lego. Like, symbolically, almost replace the former city hall, the town that is very much about Lego. Instead of a city hall, you would have the Lego house. The idea was that maybe for the Lego house, just like the architecture of the Lego house is faithful to the proportions of Lego. Every artifact, every piece of furniture, so everything you touch in the Lego house is actually made out of Lego.
So you were saying just before that, Vicky, that it's made to look like Lego.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And Bjarke says some interesting things about how a lot of architecture is almost based on some of the principles of Lego.
Yeah, it was really interesting, actually. So one of the things that they've done is the whole building is clad in these white ceramic tiles, which are the same proportions as the classic 2x4 Lego brick, so that classic rectangle shape with the 8 studs on top. And he said that, you know, when they were sort of designing the proportions of all the building using this as their base, they took the height of 18 centimetres because this apparently in architecture is the comfortable height of a step. So it's sort of what you begin with.
Okay.
And when you increase that measurement proportionally,
yeah,
you get a length of 60 centimetres,
okay,
which is about 2 feet. And that is the standard measurement used by carpenters and masons and everything. You just get everything in 60 centimetres.
It all comes
so
back
it all
to the
comes
brick.
Together. So yeah, he said that, you know, just like you have kind of the golden ratio or the Fibonacci sequence in nature, so you have the Lego brick in architecture.
It's terribly profound, but just to, well, not lower the tone, but to bring it back to fun toys, this whole building looks like it was made of Lego. It's kind of got the same aesthetic, the same bright colours on the outside, and it's really, really beautiful architecturally, the sort of block-like mm-hmm. formations. But then you get inside,
and there's loads of Lego!
And there's loads of Lego! Dinosaurs, the size of dinosaurs made
yeah.
of Lego.
Yeah, there's some really, truly amazing sculptures, some of which have been made especially for the building and some which have been brought there by master Lego builders who have been invited to kind of exhibit their work. One of the most incredible things is called the Lego Tree of Creativity. And this stands the whole height of the building up in one of the stairwells. It's got more than 6 million bricks in it. It's huge.
Are you allowed to touch the stuff?
I suppose you could. I think that one actually is glued together just for safety's sake, because if yeah. a branch fell off, it could kill someone. And it has got a steel structure inside because 6 million Lego bricks is very heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's quite cute. It kind of tells the story of Lego. So because, you know, the tree trunk is made of wood. And Lego started out making wooden toys, not plastic bricks.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, and then it's got these like carvings in the Lego trunk of sort of the old founder's initials and so on. And then as you go up, the different branches have different Lego sets kind of set out on them. So the classic yellow castle, which I think dates back to the 70s, and then some of the more modern ones. And at the top, you've got a crane because it's still being built.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
But not a real crane, a Lego crane.
A Lego crane. Everything's Lego, yeah. Of course.
So what things should real Lego connoisseurs be watching out for when they, you know, visit the Lego house?
There are so many treats. It's amazing. So, so yeah, there are a couple kind of Easter eggs that you can find out if you're a massive Lego nerd or an affol, as we learn.
Nice.
So one of my favourite rooms has these massive dioramas made of Lego. So whole cityscapes or islands just built of Lego.
And like in my one of them, dream.
Yeah, right. Yeah. In one of them, if you look close enough, you can find a little minifigure on a Segway. going down a hill. And this is Kjeld Kirk Christiansen, a former Lego president, who's kind of a bit famous for the time that he fell off his beloved Segway and broke his leg.
This is so good. And there's also a vault buried deep underground that contains a version of every single Lego set ever made.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is incredible. So it's like this archive to the company's history that's there, proofed against nuclear apocalypse, floods, anything.
Awesome.
The Lego will survive.
I love that. It's like when the apocalypse... Is the seed bank... Forget the seed bank. Is the Lego bank okay?
Yeah, can I rebuild my yellow castle?
Is this a place that people can go to? Is it like a
museum so thing? It's actually sort of meant... for the local community of Billund as well. So the ground floor, you can just go in free of charge, and they've got the Lego store and different restaurants and things. And then you can buy a ticket to go into the kind of building experiences and see the big sculptures and so on. So it's kind of symbolically almost like the town hall of Billund, because if you've ever been to Billund, it's quite a small town and it is just absolutely dominated by Lego.
It's Legoland. Literally.
Yeah.
Literally is Legoland.
Exactly.
The last thing I'd like to cover on this, because this wraps it all up really neatly, is of course there is a Lego set for the Lego house.
Yes. You can build your own version of the Lego house using a new Lego set, which you can only buy there.
Which I kind of love.
Mm.
It's really, really brilliant. And the shop was closed when you went, so the photographer you went with had to buy one for you and bring it back.
By the time we'd finished shooting, the shops were closed and I couldn't buy one. So I was frantically texting the photographer who was staying an extra night. And he brought me one back.
So we have one of these very, very precious Lego sets in the office, which I believe Mike Dent is going to do a speed build of.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mike is our... Well, Vicky is our resident Lego correspondent. Mike is our resident master builder. So I'm sure we'll be posting that up on Twitter and whatnot in the coming days. Now, a little bit of a special treat next up. Last week, I sat down with Microsoft CEO and current Wired magazine cover star Satya Nadella to talk about how he's changing the company, developments in quantum computing, and much more besides. This sits alongside the cover story that Greg, our editor, wrote, which is a fascinating read, but we wanted to hear more from the man himself. So we met at Lord's in London, and I started off by asking cricket mad Nadella how it felt to visit the home of cricket for the first time.
Oh, it's just phenomenal. You know, it's one of these things where you know everything about the place. You heard about the long room, you heard about the dressing rooms, you heard about the honors board, and you see it. It's pretty magical.
Yeah. And it's an unusual thing to be working at the very front of technology, and then also to have a passion for a sport that's probably more traditional than any other. What do you learn to take from one to the other?
I mean, for me, cricket is something that I grew up with in India and has been a passion of mine. And I think I have that romantic attachment to the game. And it's taught me a lot. In fact, in retrospect, I would say, what does it mean to be a leader is something that I learned from observing a cricket captain of mine in high school. I think what it means to be part of a team, because individual brilliance is wonderful, but it's nothing if you can't compose as a team. The need to compete, after all, business is about being able to get the best out of you by competing. So playing team sport, in my case, cricket, however traditional it is, I think test cricket is one of the more interesting. It's much more akin to real business, because it's not like, you know, 2020, it's not, you know, one innings or quick. It's intricate, and the tapestry of test cricket, I think, captures perhaps more life and real business.
Do you think that that's an attitude that certainly a lot of technology companies haven't had in recent years, that kind of real attention to the intricacies?
I think one of the things I've also, I must say, perhaps most learned in my 3.5 years as CEO is how multi-constituent the job is and the environment is. You know, it's about customers and partners and shareholders and employees and governments across all the countries that we operate in simultaneously. You can't even compartmentalize it, but you have to harmonize all of the interests. So in that sense, I think business leaders and businesses live within the broader context of the markets, the societies, and the economies they serve, and thinking about it broadly beyond their own quote-unquote operation, I think is a necessary thing and an important endeavor.
You talk about broadness, and when you took over Microsoft, to perhaps oversimplify it, the company was very much focused on Windows and Office. And obviously you came from the Microsoft Cloud Computing division. Since then, it seems to have grown and to put its focus into new areas. What challenges does that present?
I mean, I think one of the things that I feel that Microsoft has done well is we do actually have a fairly diversified portfolio, but all coming together with a sense of unified purpose. For example, we have a very big business serving productivity needs of enterprises. But we now have complemented that with even things like LinkedIn, which is for the rest of the professionals outside of work. That's where even a lot of PCs, even at home, are still used for a lot of creation. Even if other devices are used for consumption, PC is still the quintessential creation device. We have a gaming passion, whether it is PC gaming or Xbox, and now with Xbox Live. That's another massive business for us. We also have business applications, where we really have a very growing competitive business with Dynamics 365. And lastly, the cloud business and the cloud infrastructure business. So in some sense, all of these things have linkages. They all come from that sense of purpose at Microsoft, which is to empower people and organizations all over the planet to achieve more. It's we build technology so that others can build more technology. But at the same time, that depth and breadth gives us a lot of strength and diversity.
And that's what sets you apart structurally from, not to say your rivals, but other companies in the space, Apple, Facebook, Google. A large part of your remit has seemingly been to change Microsoft's culture. So I'm interested to know, what do you think sets Microsoft apart culturally from the likes of Apple, Google, Facebook?
I mean, one thing that I've realized is, as they say, anyone can probably steal your product or anyone can imitate some of your capability. But the one thing that they can't take away is your culture, because it's the more sort of non-transportable thing from place to place. So I would not even want to compare our culture to the other cultures. But what we are focused on is how can we use our culture and cultivate it so that it helps us innovate, helps us compete. And that's where we talk a lot about this notion of growth mindset, which is let's be learn-it-alls versus know-it-alls as an important element. Not that we will ever reach this destination, not that we will ever be done transforming, but use this as a push for continuous renewal, because that's what innovation needs. I mean, the one thing constant in tech is that you have to keep innovating, and there's no way you can do that if you're a know-it-all. You better have that curiosity that pushes you to learn new things and then bring things that are novel into the market.
This idea of innovation and secular nature of it's quite interesting. We've had in London recently Uber coming up against regulators here. And some people have criticized the regulators by saying that they're anti-innovation. They want to close doors to innovation. And it's this idea that innovation is an unstoppable force, whereas actually it's not necessarily. It's something that needs consideration.
I mean, the way I look at it is, I think innovation is necessary. New technology is necessary to drive our societies and economies forward. But also we should be clear-eyed about the unintended consequences of any new technology.
Because innovation isn't apolitical, it can be very political.
Well, I mean, I think that any instrument of technology or innovation can be used in many, many ways. And the question is, how do we as societies use them for the good that they can do, and also in a clear-eyed way deal with any issues? For example, when the telegraph was invented, there was wire fraud. We figured out how to deal with it. We are continuously fighting some of the cyber criminals today. And so I think with any new fundamental technology, we will have to really make sure we don't shut out the technology because of the fear of the unintended consequence, but first apply it to broadly help us make progress, and then also deal with the unintended consequence.
So unintended consequence. When Microsoft was developing Office and Windows applications in the 1990s, there was a fairly clear line between what you were attempting to achieve, what you were able to produce, and how people used it. You made Excel, and it allowed people to make spreadsheets in a very simple way. With developments in artificial intelligence, that line is a little less clear. In fact, you could say it's a lot less clear. What are the unintended consequences that concern you in artificial intelligence?
I mean, I think the way I think about even artificial intelligence is it's very similar to even the early days of software in terms of taking the mundane stuff out of our lives, empowering us to get more out of every moment of our life. I mean, one great example is this app we launched called Seeing AI, which allows anyone with visual impairment to be able to use the latest computer vision technology to be able to see. So you know, I was talking to one of my colleagues, Angela Mills, who walks in to our cafeteria now and is able to order because she has some visual impairment. She can go into conference rooms with confidence. We have learning tools inside of Word and OneNote which enable kids with dyslexia to read. So I would say first and foremost, let's grab hold of those opportunities to enhance the human experience because of AI. But to your point, I think we also should really deal with the issue of what about the runaway AI problem? If there was some optimization and we lose control of it, what would it mean? Or even the displacement problem. How do we employ people, whether with the machine or if they completely have to change jobs, how do we help them find the new skills and the new jobs? These are all, I think, challenges that we as a society and us as technology companies all need to step up and do some of our very best work.
But does some of the reporting and maybe public, not hysteria, but perception of the AI threats, certainly Hollywood's had its part to play in making people think of things like Skynet and the Terminator, whatever it may be. Does it make you feel slightly weary that this is how people see this kind of technology?
I think that we should make sure that that's why we are able to communicate the benefits. The good news is that as some of these new AI products are coming out and they are showing how people can use them to benefit, in fact, if anything, bring more people into our economy, I think that the benefits will become clear. But I think we should also make sure that all the things that have been prophesized in terms of the things that could go wrong don't happen. And it's up to us. We need to we shouldn't abdicate our responsibility in creating good AI. I sometimes think of this as just like good user experience. There's such a thing as good AI, and it's up to us to really make sure we do our best work in enshrining a set of principles, like how are we accountable for algorithm? How do we make sure we're building AI to empower humans? How do we make the AI itself intelligible, not just intelligent? These are all challenges that I think we have to step up to.
And to some extent, it's uncharted territory for the technology industry. So we have things like the Partnership on AI, where Microsoft and Apple and Google and Facebook and many others are working with academics on this problem. And there's been a huge rush amongst your colleagues in Silicon Valley to get in the very brightest minds to solve these artificial intelligence problems, both as a technological problem, but also as a societal problem. Is there a concern in Microsoft that bringing too much of that academia within corporate culture can somehow damage academia?
Quite frankly, I think this is a place where taking partnership around AI as one example, that I think is a key one, where not only do the tech firms have to come together, but all the other participants, whether from academia or even the broader civil society, I think is important, so that there is a level of transparency and a level of sharing of what we are doing. I mean, take something like intelligible AI, or testing around accountability for AI. These are all, I think, things that should become best practices that are standardized and broadly shared so that there is more trust and confidence in the public, because that's in our interest. And so is it in the interest of the economy and the society that we can, in fact, take new technology and use it for the good it can do while we all have the mechanisms to keep away the unintended consequences.
It's linked in an academic sense. Quantum computing, if we're looking at AI as something that's coming up quite fast, quantum computing might not be that far away to being properly realized. What are your ambitions for it, and what's your focus?
On quantum or?
Yeah, quantum.
For us, quantum, whether it's mixed reality, AI, or quantum, they're all long-term projects for us. But there is a lot of immediate applicability and progress we are making with both mixed reality and AI. But with quantum, we started 10 years ago. and said, okay, you know, one of the challenges we're running into is the Moore's Law is sort of not, you know, delivering at least even linear computational increases like it used to. So the question is, what do we do next? And there are still many computational problems. We don't know how the natural enzymes in food production work. We don't know how to produce a catalyst that can absorb carbon. So these are computational problems that are still unsolved. And if we try to solve them using a classical computer, it'll take all the time from Big Bang to now. And so we said, okay, let's start a program, not just to kind of create one or two milestones, but what is a path towards general quantum computing. And we brought a unique sort of part of math, this topological matter and topology, with breakthroughs in physics where you can instantiate these Majorana particles that in fact exhibit topological matter. And then on top of that, a new computer science stack which works with qubits. And we are making progress. It's still some time for us to put it all together, but it's an ambitious project. But we are excited about what it could mean to solve some of the most pressing problems of the world.
So you're here today in part to talk about your book, which came out recently, Hit Refresh. I wonder, as a great reader, if you could give our listeners a recommendation of what they should be reading, not your book, based on what you've enjoyed recently.
One of the books that I just recently read was The Galleys of Walter Isaacson's new book on Da Vinci. Beautifully done, like Walter always does. But it just shows what a coming together of science and art he represented at one of the most amazing times, which is the Renaissance. It was a very fascinating read. I think it's something that people should pick up and read.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
So to get more of your fix of Satya Nadella, you can read Greg's feature, which is in the current issue of Wired magazine. It's also online if you don't like buying print publications, but you totally should because it's a beautiful thing. We'll finish, as we always do, with a quiz. Sorry in advance. Earlier this week, we published a story about an ICO for an AI blockchain, which is probably the most tech hype idea of the year. But how much do you know about the blockchain?
Little.
Well, I feel that there's two words in that what you just said that maybe we should clarify before we move on.
No.
ICO?
Yeah. Well, AI, artificial intelligence. Okay, so how much do you know about the blockchain? Question one. The first distributed blockchain was conceptualized in 2008 by an anonymous person or group known as...
Satoshi Nakamoto.
Yeah, I wasn't pronounced it right, but... In my head, it sounded like that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Legit?
Yeah.
Okay, you can both have a point. Yes, it was, of course.
I took the biggest point. I'm going to do that next
Nakamoto.
Year.
Yeah, just say, I agree.
Well, yeah, what she said.
In the world of cryptocurrency, what does ICO stand for?
I know this one as well. I know this one.
Matt, do you want to go first?
I know. It's initial coin offering.
I knew that too.
I should have got you to say
it. It's funny because writing down our answers and holding it up, it doesn't work well on podcasts.
No, okay. I'll get you both to say your answer at the same time for the next one. Okay, so that's two all. Very good. Bonus point if you can explain what an ICO is.
I can.
Go on.
So it's basically when, say I have some kind of cryptocurrency related business or something. I'm making a new cryptocurrency token, but instead of asking for like VC funding or something for my business, I tell people to buy the token for the thing that I haven't yet made on the kind of understanding that they will then be able to use the token in the thing that I am saying that I am going to make.
Yeah. Or as Wired's resident cryptocurrency correspondent Jan Volpicelli put it, it's a bit like a token, like a supermarket coupon.
Right.
So, you know, for a supermarket that hasn't been built yet.
Yes. And that's worth technically nothing until the supermarket proves it's worth. So it's like if you have a Tesco's loyalty card. Tesco's is a big supermarket here in the UK if you're from overseas, and you get points. You get club card points, which are essentially worthless, but you can collect them and then use them to buy things of worth. So the idea is that you invest in an idea that doesn't really exist yet in order to get value out of it at a later date.
But they're not they're not launching a currency every time they do this, right? It's just a coupon for the thing.
No, people would pay in Ether, Bitcoin, or maybe even regular currency to have part of the token system for an idea that isn't yet built.
But then you exchange that token eventually for a thing.
Like yes.
You hope so.
Yeah.
Right. So this is the problem with it. There's a lot of potential for fraud or for, just speculation on the token market for something that may not actually ever materialize.
It just has a more complicated way of doing it, doesn't it? I don't know. I'd just be like, give me $100 and I'll give you $100 credit when I make my, aquarium website.
Yeah, but then if you don't pay back, people come around and start breaking your knuckles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that is kind of how VC works, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And capitalism.
I don't know. I just don't know. I don't see
Stop describing
really
common
things.
I don't know, really
I don't know
really
why we need
ways.
Fish coin to do it.
Well, let's move on to question three. So it's 2-2. Oh, well, no, actually,
that
Vicky,
was question
gets,
three.
No, that was the bonus question.
Oh.
So it's 3-2 to Vicky on the bonus question. Which of these isn't a cryptocurrency? Dogecoin, Titcoin, or Brexit coin?
Brexit coin, surely.
I'm going to say Brexit coin.
Yeah, you're both right. So
I don't know why we were like, oh, Titcoin, that's definitely
a
thing.
If you spend any time in the Bitcoin community, exactly. You can kind of surmise that will definitely
so be. So Dogecoin was introduced as a joke currency in December 2013. It now has a capitalization of $340 million. What a good joke. Titcoin, depressingly, is a cryptocurrency that lets you pay for pornographic content online that can't be traced back to your credit card. And Brexit coin is something that I just made up but might come in quite useful as the pound continues to slide. Question four. In 2010, a year after Bitcoin launched, a single Bitcoin was valued at 4 US cents. Or maybe it was 2. Maybe it was 4 pence. But anyway, it was either 4 cents or 4 pence.
Not much, basically.
Yeah. How much is one Bitcoin worth now?
$4,000?
I don't. It
had a bit of a blip, didn't it, recently?
I think it was around 2,000 and then maybe up to 3,000.
So your final...
So, but right now I'm going to say 2,500?
I'm going to say 4,000.
Oh, yes. Yes. $4,400.
Wow.
Bitcoin.
Unless it's crashed in the last 20 minutes since we started recording, which is always possible. No, it seems to be... fairly stable, definitely not a bubble. So that's 3-all or 4-all anyway. Oh no, Vicky's one ahead. No, she's not. Yes, it's 3-all. I should really write this all down. Final question. This one's a doozy. Who was the first musical artist to start accepting Bitcoin payments for their work? You'll never get it.
Snoop Dogg.
Oh, that's almost right. Because he was the second.
Are you kidding? I'm definitely not going to know who this is. I don't know anything about music.
It's a really, really well-known musical artist, but probably not the one that you'd think.
What you're saying? So it's the second most popular musical artist around right now?
No. The name will shock you.
Is it ASAP Rocky, but the S is a dollar sign? It's a Bitcoin sign.
No, it's former Spice Girl Mel B.
No, yes. That has shocked me.
Mel B with the Bitcoin
system. Yes,
that's why she did it, for the branding. No, I love how new technology makes our lives easier, Mel B said. And to me, that's exciting. Bitcoin unites my fans around the world using one currency. They can just pay using Bitcoins.
Oh, so both of them use Bitcoin?
No, so Snoop Dogg announced that his new album was going to be available to purchase in Bitcoin, but then Mel B got ahead of him by saying, oh, my new single, out right now, pay for it in Bitcoin.
What I love is it's like Mel B is trying to start the Mel B Snoop Dogg beef that never existed.
And never should exist.
The famous.
So I hope we've learned a lot about Bitcoin, had some laughs.
Yeah. Learned something. I learned that.
We all learned something. I think that ended up 3-all, right? Although maybe you should get a bonus point for Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
I think I should.
Yeah. Okay, great. You win. There you go.
That feels unfair.
Bring your A game next week, Matt Reynolds.
Yeah, sorry.
We'll leave it there for this week. Thank you very much for listening. As always, we will see you again next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.